Welcome back to the Gucci Podcast. On this new episode, we are talking to Jeremy Deller about his film Everybody in the Place. This documentary on acid house and rave music is part of Second Summer of Love, a four-part series in collaboration with Freeze. Written and directed by Jeremy, the documentary explores the social history of the UK between 1885 and 1993 through the lens of acid house and rave music. The film, Everybody in the Place, is based on a real-life lecture given to a class of students in London. Interviewing Jeremy is Matthew McLean, Freeze Studios' senior editor.
Hello, I'm Matthew McLean. I'm senior editor at Freeze Studios, and I'm here with the artist Jeremy Deller for a special episode of Gucci Podcast. For the second Summer of Love film series, which Freeze is working on in collaboration with Gucci, exploring the history of dance music, Jeremy has made Everybody in the Place, an incomplete history of Britain, 1984 to 1992. Jeremy and I today are going to talk about the film in which he takes us into a real class in a London school and leads an interactive kind of lesson exploring the emergence of the rave scene across Britain and looking at what it can tell us about the wider social, political and cultural changes of the era. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
So the so-called Second Summer of Love was 1988, 30 years ago. This year.
That's right.
You were 22 then, living in London. Did you have a personal experience at the time? Was that the beginning of your relationship to the scene, or were you drawn to it more from an external interest?
I had no connection with it at the time. I had nothing to do with it. I came to it a bit later. But even when it was happening, I knew that it was important. But I think I was a bit put off by it. And I'm not really into crowds of people, so I didn't really want to go to big parties with loads and loads of people. I didn't think I had anyone that would go with me, friends and that. So I just observed it. And then later, probably 2 years later, I probably got more into going to those kinds of things and getting into the music more. But even when it began, like I said, I knew that it was important. I was just trying to work out why it was important. Or how is important. But I was definitely an observer.
And when you selected it as an era to explore for this project, did you already have a sense of not just that it was important, but why it was important? Did you have an instinct? Or maybe you could just talk for the listener about what drew you to it.
22 years ago, in 1996, I did a diagram because I had an idea for brass bands to play acid house music. It was called Acid Brass, and I made a diagram that connected the culture of brass bands to that of acid house, two music forms that really, you could argue, have nothing common whatsoever, but I felt they had a lot in common. And in that diagram, it really plotted out my interests in music and history and social history, and the history of Britain especially. And really that diagram served as my sort of template or script for this film. So it's really about the beginning of the scene, of the music, but also the the history, 20th century and 19th century history of Britain and how it relates to youth culture and to the music, as I saw it. I mean, it's massively subjective, but it was something I've been thinking about for a long time and wanting to examine more.
For a listener who hasn't seen it, you describe the diagram, how many terms or thought bubbles or arrows it would count
It's called The History of the World, and there's two main parts to it. One is acid house, one is brass bands, and it's a diagram that shows the connection between the two, but within that there's the beginning of dance music in terms of techno, music that came before what we'd call house music, so Kraftwerk and so on. There's a part about the miners' strike, about media hysteria around acid house and the miners' strike. There are parts of this diagram about the north of England, about folk culture, about the end of industry and so on. So it has a lot within it. And actually a diagram is a very good way of connecting lots of things. There's something about drug culture as well, and that, of course, led to media hysteria. So it really is about, as I saw it, how acid house and how this culture fitted into British history, but also into dance music history. And in the film, I've made a film about that, really, about that diagram, effectively, and how what came before is just as interesting as what comes after or what happened at the time.
And the format you've chosen for the film, or the device, is of a a lesson.
Yeah.
Can you explain? Well, I mean, obviously that will come out of the diagram kind of thinking.
Yes.
You could talk more about that sort of decision.
What I didn't want to do was make a film. I wanted to make a documentary. And what I didn't want to do was make a documentary where it's just a bunch of middle-aged men sitting in recording studios, a bit like this, talking about the glory days and about how they made the tracks and how amazing it was to be out of their heads and going to parties and clubs and, you know, it was amazing and all that kind of stuff. And so I didn't want a reminiscing style film or reminiscent style film, whatever you want to call it. And so I wanted to make the structure to be based around now, effectively, about young people now. And their reaction to it, not just to the music, but to the history of the time. So that's why there's a lot. It's not just about dance music. The film has a lot of politics within it. I'm trying to give them a context, really. And so I was very much interested in bringing it up to date and getting another perspective. And also when you're watching the film, you might also be thinking about these young people because they're watching the same archive as you are when you're watching the film and just wondering what it means to them to watch something about the miners' strike or Traveller movement and Stonehenge in 1986, for example. So it's to see it through their eyes and just not to see it through the eyes of a bunch of middle-aged men, which is the usual route for these sorts of films, when people just remember stuff.
In terms of their young people's today's, their distance, I guess, from the material and some of your own distance. How difficult was it, or how easy was it, conversely, to evoke that in terms of the you know, how did you approach trying to get a sense of what it would be like to be at a rave?
Well, I wasn't trying to do that. I wasn't trying to explain what it was like to be at a rave, really. I was, in a sense, I was trying to explain how it came about and why it came about and why Britain and what were the circumstances in Britain and how the end of industry in Britain and our industrial culture gave an urgency to the music and helped the music, amongst other things. And also about the repressive nature of the 80s as well. It was a very authoritarian time. And so when something comes up that is the opposite of authoritarian, it's actually quite a shock because it makes it a very political moment, even though there's no explicit politics within it. So it's all about that, really, about what it was like to grow up in the 80s and live in the 80s. If anything, I think the young people were more interested in the politics than they were the music. There was a very good quote. One of the first things that's said by one of the young people is about, they can't believe it, no one's got phones, and how different it is. Because no one's got phones, people are behaving in a different way. They're not self-conscious, and so the way people are dancing and behaving is unusual for them.
Were you surprised that the lack of familiarity of some of those points in history?
Yes, in a way, but they're politics. Well, the other thing, they were politics students, but obviously politics is taught in a different way. I think it's about the structure of politics within Britain, the structures of parties and legislation and parliament and how elections are run and so on. They don't necessarily look at the social history aspect of politics. So the miners' strike for these young people was the first. And in the film, we show, you know, quite a brutal clip, very famous sequence, quite long as well, nearly 2 minutes, with a song over.
What happens in that sequence?
Well, it's all grieve. It's the picket at all grieve, which is, you know, notorious now and something I've looked at myself. And it's the footage of the en masse, you know, the miners trying to break through the police lines and the police charging them down. There's destruction, there's cars on fire. I mean, it's a proper riot or battle. It's more a battle than a riot because it's really so clearly two sides against each other. And so they weren't used to seeing that. And you can tell there's some cutaways of them looking at it. They're quite shocked by it, quite upset by it even. So I didn't hold back in that respect because it is some of the most brutal footage of the strike and a really important moment. And the track over it or under it is What Time Is Love, the original version from 89, which, of course, was made 5 years after All Grieve itself. But I'm trying to explain to them that actually, if it hadn't been All Grieve and the miners' strike, you might not have had a track like What Time Is Love. Songs like that come out of people's dissatisfaction and what they've seen. It's, you know, and the how Britain was changed because of the strike and so on. So it's, which I know is partially true because I know the person that wrote it, and we've spoken about that moment in history, and he's very aware of Orgreave, and he was, you know, he's done work around it as well. So he said, he talked to me about the horses and how shocking that was. And in a way, maybe subconsciously, What Time Is Love is about the miners' strike. Who knows?
There was one idea that I thought I was very struck by. You're reflecting on the fact that many... The scene of a lot of raves was warehouses or ex-factories or places once of work. There was a suggestion of drawing a kind of a parallel in some way between the idea of the factory space as hot, as crowded, as repetitive, and the kind of the rave space as being almost a kind of echo or a ghost of
dangerous,
that.
Deafening place of sort of exploitation. You know, there are similarities, I think. Even the sounds of music as well. It's not the ironworks or the steelworks, which is like the clanking hammer, which is the sound of heavy metal. This is a more rhythmic sound. If you go into or you hear a mill, it's much more rhythmic, and it's a different kind of sound. Maybe that's why the music scene in Manchester has always been about dance or meeting of rock and dance rather than of metal. There's no metal scene in Manchester. The metal is elsewhere, and that might be to do with the whole culture of the cotton industry, and the sound of the cotton industry is different. It's much more rhythmic or polyrhythmic even. So yes, I did think that it was a great opportunity, but just at the moment when people were trying to find big spaces, industrial spaces or warehouses to have parties in, all these places were becoming available because of the recession and the deindustrialization of these parts of Britain, in the north especially, which might explain why the north of Britain, the music actually took much better hold than it is in the south, I'd argue. In the south, it was more bucolic. It was more... It's how it feels, sort of the countryside and tents. But in the north, it was much more... It seemed to be much more based around former industrial sites.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There's a scene in the film where the students stand up and read the name and location of iconic... nightclub venues,
yeah.
And around the British Isles, and there's only one in London.
Yes, and I would have taken that out. If I'd have thought about it, I wouldn't have had it in. I didn't want to have anything from London, and I didn't really want the Hacienda in. I actually wanted to make a documentary about house and that movement without mentioning the Hacienda.
And is that because you feel that those are just too have too much presence in popular histories, or that there is something that really they were sort of not relevant as far as you're concerned to the movement, and the regional story is the real story?
Well, I think Hacienda is really monopolised on people's attention when it comes to that part of the world and clubs and going out, and it's been a very well-worn path, and the story told by very articulate, witty, interesting people, so they get to say it. You know, the people. They get to tell the story again and again and again. And of course, there's loads of other clubs, loads of other things happening, which were probably more authentic. So, yes, I wanted to pay my respects to all these funny little clubs all around Britain that were these lifesavers for people, were just amazing places for people to go where you'd hear this music and just have the time of your life. So it's meant to be quite an optimistic end. And I just love the names of clubs anyway, and especially when you hear the name of the club and you hear where it is in Britain, like Stroud and, you know, all these little towns and that, and you just think, these places must have been amazing. They were, you know, I don't care about Studio 54. I would want to be at Shelley's Laser Dome in Stoke. You know, that seems like the place to be in the world. And so that's what I was interested in just paying homage to them, because for me, that's where the real spirit was.
You described that clip from Shelley's, which maybe you could describe what's going on in it. Mm. But in particular in the description, you refer to it as almost heartbreaking, which is, I'm sort of interested in talking about ending on an optimistic note and the optimism, and also how that's balanced with the story you're telling, which is actually one about a great deal of uncertainty for the people in this movement and and as you're saying, a very traumatic period socially.
Well, I think it's just it's a shot. Someone went into Shelley's, which is this great rave club. I think he's 18 or 19. He's actually at the beginning of the film. There's a few of the queue, and the guy who shot the interior of the club is in the queue, and he looks like he's 12 years old or something. And he's actually a really good cameraman, and he just walked around the club quite slowly, just picking out people who were dancing really well and had a light on top for some of it. And he just did it really, it's just shot really well. It's one of the longer sequences of the film. It's maybe 2 minutes with the sound from the club. So it's not like the perfect sound, and it's so atmospheric. And I knew clubs like that. I used to go to places similar to that, probably not as good as that. And it's just these young people just really going for it. And it's just, there's something about it. And the song is, there's a kind of melancholy in the song as well. And it just makes me so proud watching it to be British. And it's so weird. And I can't explain why, really, but it's a very profound feeling of youth and the optimism of youth and enjoyment and the innocence of it. You know, they might all be on drugs, but it doesn't really matter. There's still an innocence around that. And it's like, you're this... You just thought, God, your life will never be as good as this again. That's how I feel, because I remember going to clubs like that and just, you know, it was the best time. So for me, it is heartbreaking. It's very poignant because there's just a poignancy around the youth and the happiness in that room.
I find that interesting. One of the other tracks appears in the film, which we'll hear on the podcast, Adonis is No Way Back.
Mm.
The lyrics are... convey this idea of being of pushing on, but in a way being kind of trapped or being on a route that you can't. So there is, it seems to me, that a kind of some kind of acknowledgement somewhere in the music of a negative state of affairs, which at the same time seems to coexist with this positive.
Yes, I mean that goes throughout, doesn't it? Goes throughout popular music as well. But I think a lot of those tracks from Chicago and Detroit were quite dark. They were quite frightening times for a lot of people. In the gay clubs, especially because of AIDS taking a grip on in the gay community. I don't know what No Way Back is about, but there's probably some sort of paranoia in it. But you know, a lot of the tracks are in sort of minor keys, if that's the right way of putting it, and they're very dark. But it's for people who really like their dance music, isn't it? Who are dancing all night and they're getting into these very intense songs.
Release my soul. Lost control, release my soul. I've lost control. Too far gone, too far gone, too far gone. Ain't no way back.
One of the images from Chicago that appears in the film is the one that possibly is the most sort of hopeful.
Mm.
I can't remember exactly how you describe it now, but is the DJ handing over to the crowd.
Yeah. That's in New York.
Oh, that's New York, okay.
But I'm talking about it within, it's either in, I might talk about it in the Detroit section when I'm talking about Kraftwerk, but it's actually Ralph Hutter from Kraftwerk handing a small keyboard into the audience for them to play. It's when they play Pocket Calculator. Kraftwerk used to go out to the front of the audience and play these tiny one-octave synths that they'd obviously made and would play all these... songs. It was really like a really funny kind of comedy moment for them. And this is a moment in New York where they're doing that, and Ralph is stretching right into the audience and giving these kids the keyboard to play on. And this is actually, you know, these two black kids, and they're just touching the computer. I mean, it's amazing. I think it's like a religious artwork almost, this handing over this technology and this participation in it. But it's an amazing image. And I'm surprised I've never seen it before, because it should go down as one of the most important sort of images of rock. It tells a story, really, of handing over of what Kraftwerk basically did. They handed over electronic music to America, and America just ran with it and took it somewhere amazing, especially Black America. And basically that's what's happening in this picture.
You talk about it in terms of handing over the means of production.
Yes. I always thought that there was something really interesting seeing people make music and take over the control. And maybe this is a moment where people did, you know, they set up their own labels, their own distribution, they made the records at home. They didn't have to rely on the usual structures, which are effectively the structures of rock music. The record industry is basically based around rock music, isn't it? And those hierarchies. And this began to destroy those hierarchies, and maybe was the began to sort of lessen the grip of the music industry on music making and production and so on. So, yes, it's kind of exciting, isn't it, when people get hold of a bit of technology and then use it in a way that was never expected, like the 303, and lots of other bits of equipment, really. So that was, for me, that was always like that.
Another moment which I think I was really struck with, when you move to the sort of the New Age Traveller part of the film, and there's lots of footage of confrontation almost, or on a much less violent scale than Orgreave, but between people who live in the countryside and sort of and the crusties who've sort of arrived and
yes.
inhabiting their towns. And you ask one of the students if they whether they relate to this kind of rebellious youth, and they're actually offer quite a well, maybe you could talk about the response.
She's not really into it. She thinks she just doesn't get it. But
well,
you know, a lot of these
I don't
kids...
know if she's, it seems to me almost that she doesn't get, but she sort of seems to acknowledge that, like, that young people today, that youth, that the rebelliousness have gone out of youth now.
Yes,
I think, and it,
she says it's just
it's a rejection. It's slightly actually melancholy.
Well, she kind of goes around in a circle. She starts by saying it's just a party lifestyle. And then she says, now we get status through social media. Then you got status through other things, through music or through this kind of rebelliousness. But I think what's interesting about the group of young people is a lot of them, almost majority of them, come from families where their parents probably weren't born in Britain. And maybe some of those young people weren't born in Britain either. So, again, that's another layer to consider about what they're looking at these people. We can't quite maybe work out who they are. But it is quite difficult to understand when you see, you can imagine a bunch of kids who are being told to work hard by their parents who've just arrived in Britain, or quite recently, they've got to get on. And then you see these young people, a bit older than them, almost exclusively white, who've dropped out and are just like hanging around the countryside and trying to get to Stonehenge and getting arrested and all that. It's quite alien to their existence in a city, in London, maybe. But for me, I love that sequence. It's quite a long piece of archive because there's some amazing bits of people arguing in the street about them, which is incredible. Well, I asked the students to say, what do you think is going to happen next? I show them a still of two elderly people looking really angry, and they assume that these people are angry with the young people, with the travellers, but actually it's the opposite. And it's kind of, and I would assume too that they'd hate the travellers, but they weren't at all. They're very sympathetic to them and just hate the police, which was quite surprising. So it's full of surprises, that clip, and contradictions about Britain.
What I'm interested in, I mean, to many people, Britain today is in or on the brink of as much chaos and radical change as Britain of 88.
Yes.
And yet at the same time, as we're acknowledging this conversation as comes out through the film, expressions of youth culture or of culture at large at the same time have kind of irrevocably moved on. So the question is, do you see the possibility for as seismic a movement as Rave today, or how do you think, looking back, what do you think, you know, what's going to be the equivalent?
If I could predict it, that would be amazing to be able to predict it, but something's going to happen, isn't it? Well, it's happening in technology, I think, but I don't know if it will happen again in music on that scale, but it could do. I know there's big parties happen, don't they? Big illegal parties happen all over the place. But I don't know what the next thing will be, to be honest. I really don't, or the next person. But I hope it happens. And something will happen. But whether it be on that scale or not is another matter. There's been nothing since, really, of that importance. Before that, it was punk. But, yeah, since that moment, I don't think there's been anything really of that importance that's happened. But it was about the future as well. It's definitely a music about the future. It's not retro in the way that Britpop was, which happened, you know, 5-6 years after. So, and was like a record industry thing. This was a very important moment. But hopefully something will happen. And that's a really great track. It's an amazing track, actually. And that was... I kept hearing it on Looking at Archive. It kept coming up because it's obviously... I don't remember it, but I must have danced it, but I just don't remember it. But anyway, it was... As soon as I heard it, I just thought, this is actually really quite a cinematic track because there's a minute build-up and then it gets very frenetic and it's really heavy. But as soon as I heard it, I thought, oh, that's the trailer. That, with the footage of that camera just going along the queue, it's just perfect. Kind of this expectation of something is about to happen, people are waiting for something to happen, then the track kicks in and then you just go to all the footage of people dancing. I just thought, this is perfect.
Well, I love that in the title, in brackets, Paradise Is Now. So you have a build-up and then a drop and the sort of sense of, like,
well, in
it's
a way,
now.
Yes, and that's the club, isn't it? You know, that's the club at the end, which is the club of the queue. The queue at the beginning and the club at the end are the same club. And, that's true. Paradise was then. It's like you're living it. You're in the moment. And you're in the moment also for another reason. You're not... no one's filming you or taking pictures of you on their phone and posting them immediately. So that's really important as well. But I think that track stands a test of time as well. It sounds as good now as it did then.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Pleasure.
And you can see Everybody in the Place, An Incomplete History of Britain, 1984 to 1992, at Frieze London Art Fair. And find out more on Gucci.com and Frieze.com.
Thank you for listening to the Gucci Podcast. Go to Gucci.com to discover more about the project in collaboration with Frieze and to find out more about Jeremy Deller's documentary film, Everybody in the Place.